So what is a hallmark of a mature believer? I think it's somebody who's willing to elevate God and willing to pay a cost in their own life to do so.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Last week, Jack, I think we had just a really interesting discussion for me. And we talked about what is maturity. What does a mature believer look like? What does their life look like? What do their attitudes look like toward themselves, toward other people, toward God? I wonder if, real briefly, if I can put it on you to kind of summarize what we said and then go on today and talk about some of the people in the Bible and their maturity and or lack of maturity.
Okay. Well, we made what I think is a crucial distinction between maturity on the one hand and moral perfection on the other hand, that maturity is not moral perfection. Moral perfection is actually what the Bible calls glory, the glory that awaits us in the kingdom of God to come. Maturity coincides with imperfection. It coincides with being broken, imperfect people. But while we are broken, while we are imperfect, while we are fundamentally evil and unworthy creatures, if my heart and mind is committed to know God, committed to loving God, and therefore committed to the truth that God wants to teach me, the wisdom He wants to give me, and so on, that's maturity. And it's really an issue of the depth and the strength of that commitment to the things of God. The more committed I am, the stronger I am in my allegiance to God and what He stands for, the more mature I am. The more iffy that commitment is, the more vulnerable and fragile that commitment is, the less mature I am. I think that summarizes what we were saying.
Jack, I think that summarizes what we were saying really well, but I just thought of something. I don't think people will have a clue what you said.
Okay, well, maybe you should ask me some questions.
Well, I think that's a really good insight into what happens sometimes in our interactions, is you will say something that has a lot of profound meaning, and there's a lot behind it. In fact, we have just spent, for our last program, really unpacking what a spiritual/mature person would look like. And you summarized it beautifully. But I think what we need to do is go back and ask people to maybe get last week's tape. I think that would be very helpful for our ongoing discussion. Mm-hmm. But as I said earlier, I think what would be helpful is for us to unpack what you just said through looking at these biblical figures and see what maturity looked like in their life.
Okay.
Is that all right?
Sure, it'd be great.
Now, Jack, what I just said to you wasn't as much a criticism as it was a, aha, there it is. It just happened. It's right in front of me. Do you follow?
Mm-hmm.
That you are really good at summarizing things. You kind of get to the nitty-gritty of it, but it feels like a whole world got left behind. And in your mind, you included the whole world, but I don't think other people know all the pieces.
Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah, that our language is loaded with all kinds of background, and if people don't share the same background, then it doesn't really mean anything. It's kind of meaningless.
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
So we thought about sharing a couple of Bible figures. One was Paul, one was Barnabas, and the other was King David.
Mm-hmm.
So that's three.
Okay.
I wonder if we can start with Paul.
Okay.
Because I have a particular question.
Okay.
I think in Timothy, his last book, I believe, before he died, is that right?
Yeah, probably.
not certain, but certainly near the end of his life, he said, and I quote, "I am the chief of sinners." Now, this was a man that I think all of us in Christendom would say, this is a mature man, and yet he called himself the chief of sinners. He was like, as well known or better in his time as Billy Graham. Would Billy Graham be considered the chief of sinners? Would the pastor of my church or your church or is a pastor somebody who is mature and therefore not the chief of sinners? Or what in the world did Paul mean by that?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I'm not actually sure I know the answer to that, in the sense that those books are not books that I have really tackled and studied intensely. So there may be some nuance to what he means there in the context of his discussion that I'm not privy to. I mean, I just haven't decided that yet. I know what I would like to say, and I think that this is a very real possibility, that he's simply affirming the depth to which he is and remains a broken human being, unworthy of God. That's what we talked about last week, and to a large extent, is how fundamentally broken we are, and that doesn't change in this lifetime. No matter how mature a believer gets, it's still a broken human being, a morally defective human being, who is mature, who has arrived at a point of sanctification where they've established themselves as a child of God, but that doesn't change the fact that they're morally unworthy and defective. And that may very well be what he's pointing to there, but I really can't say for sure.
So I'm disappointed. I thought we could get into a rip-roaring discussion about that particular verse. Okay, well, so let's go back and say, at least, is a mature person necessarily my pastor, necessarily the elder of the church, necessarily somebody who's been a Christian for a long time?
Well, no. I mean, you would hope so. Ideally, if our churches operated as they should, they would never appoint people to be elders who weren't at a sufficient level of maturity that you could describe them as mature. And the same thing with a pastor. Ideally, that would be the case. Unfortunately, we get a distorted concept of maturity in our Christian culture. Oftentimes, what we mean by mature is simply advanced in the culture of Christianity, and therefore skillful and savvy in their social interactions with other Christians, such that they appear what we call spiritual because they have been very acclimatized to the Christian culture.
Acclimatized in the sense that they have a language.
Yeah, they know what to say, they know what to do, they know how to think in order to impress other people that they are really, truly Christian. But we're not really talking about spirituality at that point. We're talking about cultural issues.
I remember, Jack, early on as a counselor, that I started working with some people who were in the ministry, and was finding out. There were elders, there were pastors. And what kept coming in front of me was people who really had a good reputation in the community, a good reputation in their church or their Christian community, but who were having, I remember one person in particular had molested a child, and another couple of people who were having affairs. Now, these were people that were telling me that that's what they had done, or I found out through this one case, their child, and that had become an issue. But these were people who knew the talk, knew the walk, but it didn't come out of their hearts. These were people who weren't mature people at all, but everybody would swear up and down that this was a person who really didn't make errors. These were people, a couple of them were people who made grievous errors and yet were now repentant. There were a couple of them that were not repentant at all, except for they had been caught and yet wanted to continue with their ministry in their Christian ministry, whether it was in the church or some other organization. So I think, yes, ideally, that's how it should be, and yet very often it isn't that way. And I guess maybe not very often, but I see those cases often. And their congregation or the group of people they're serving may have absolutely no idea, and in fact want to emulate their lives by them.
Yeah. And I'm not articulating this very well, but what sets us up for that is that we have a faulty set of criteria for maturity.
And what do you think that criteria is?
Well, they tend to be lifestyle issues. They tend to be vocabulary, jargon criteria. You know, if someone stands up on a platform on a Sunday morning and waxes sentimental about loving Jesus, we're inclined to take that at face value and say, wow, they must be really mature. Well, yeah, the other possibility is they have become very skilled at knowing what to say that will have the impact on me of making me feel insecure about my spirituality and therefore attribute to them a higher level of spirituality than I have. I remember when I was in high school, and it became even conscious for me how this worked. You have a bunch of high school kids in a church setting, in a church youth group setting, sitting around, and I learned fairly quickly that you could always score points if you were the one to first stand up or raise your hand or make a contribution in this discussion and say something, you know what, I think the problem is we're not praying enough. And you could always score points with that. And the reason you could always score points with that is because who's going to stand up and say, oh no, I pray enough? That can't be the problem because I pray all the time and I pray enough. I mean, you always get people at a point of insecurity when you challenge the adequacy of their prayer life because I just knew for a fact it was reality. No one prayed to the degree that our theology said one ought to pray. And so you could always get people on the defensive and you could always make them insecure. And what it did is it made you appear more spiritual than any of them because you noticed the problem first. You were discerning enough. You were savvy enough to notice the problem before they did. There wasn't anything spiritual about me when I said that. I was scheming. I was conniving. It was spiritual one-upsmanship.
Very strategic.
I mean, it was totally evil what I was doing.
Right.
But as far as anyone else was concerned, I had elevated to myself to a place of real maturity in their eyes.
And I'm thinking about how did I score points and how do I score points now? And I think one of the ways back then that I scored points was I used to go to, I think it was kind of campaigners meeting where we did Bible study in my high school. And it wasn't memorization, but it was
Bible study, yeah.
It was Bible study. It was kind of like the upper echelon. I think it was right before Young Life. The Young Life group was just kind of fun and games, and we brought in new people that weren't necessarily Christian. But campaigners was for the more mature people. And I think it had, or the people that were really more interested in the Bible study and taking it more seriously in their lives. And it's definitely a good idea. But the way I scored points there was I always did my lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think it's great to do your lesson. But, man, I remember one time in particular how much – I mean, nobody did it except for me. And my teacher really shamed everybody and really held me up as somebody who always did it. And, man, was I glowing. I was so glad underneath that nobody had done their lesson because it made me look so good.
Uh-huh.
And he was just riling on them, and I was just sitting there on my little, you know, queen perch, feeling good. And I don't think anybody saw the smugness in my eyes. Maybe they did. If they were good observers, I'm sure they could have found it. But that's really a way we score points. Another way that I learned to score points, I remember being a counselor, kind of a camp counselor, and they would want us to share our testimonies. Like we would have these campouts and with the fire, and it was kind of this, you know, really special time. It's late at night, and so the counselors are getting up and sharing their testimony. Well, I learned to really give like this fabulous testimony,
mm-hmm.
And so they would ask me. You know, there'd be different groups of kids every week, and they asked me more times than other people to give my testimony because I had really gotten to have a moving testimony. Now, I was aware that my testimony really wasn't that significant. I mean, I was such a young person anyway, but I had learned to really say it in such a way that I waxed very eloquent, or at least very believable and very, you know, I was, and what it was all about. It was a bad thing. I just wanted to be liked and looked up to, and I got it, but it didn't have anything to do with being a mature believer.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember one church camp I went to, and around the campfire, a rather clever testimony that I gave, and I was so proud of myself because it was so clever, but I even recognized at the time that I didn't have the foggiest idea what I was saying. The concepts weren't even relevant to me because I was so young that, you know, faith, grace, mercy, none of that stuff really had any content to me. I just knew it was Christian jargon that put in the right permutations scored points with people. But I just did it in a particularly creative and imaginative way, and I was really proud of myself. I'm sure that I thrilled the counselors, and I intimidated and impressed my fellow campers, because I came off as really, this must be really mature. This guy must really know what he's talking about. I didn't have the foggiest idea what I was talking about. When I was the president of my youth group in high school, I would talk about mercy and grace, and I don't remember if I used hope or not. I don't think hope was in our vocabulary, but mercy and grace and various phrases, not having any deep, personal, profound grasp of what they meant, but I knew that they gave the appearance of somebody who was mature, the appearance of somebody who understood. So I know firsthand how this works. I know firsthand how you can give the appearance of maturity and not be have an ounce of maturity in your being.
Now, I want to bring up another one that I think is pretty common, and that's that being a confident appearing person.
Mm-hmm.
Those people look a lot more mature, and it may be, like I remember really getting a lot of points for looking confident. I think just because I was willing to talk a lot and kind of get out there and do things that other people might be scared to do. Well, that had just become my strategy for survival. Some people might become very shy, and that's the way to survive. And I just, out of my fears, just reacted in a different way and became a very outspoken, outgoing, can-do kind of person. Well, both of us, the shy person and I, were probably coming from the same level of immaturity, but shyness doesn't look as mature as this,
right,
this outspokenness, this this aggressiveness that I had in my personality. So that kind of personality is really looked up to. People who can speak well in front of other people tend to be very looked up to very much as mature person. People who can sing well or who can, present themselves well musically in front of other people are often seen as kind of mature people.
Right. Yep. Exactly. And all those are the wrong criteria. But I'm sad to say, I think those are the criteria that over time creep into our Christian culture, into our church cultures, and the people that we then end up seeking to emulate, the people we admire, the people we put in positions of leadership, and can end up being people who are not truly mature in the biblical sense, but are mature in this Christian culture that we create. They're advanced in the culture.
Yes. Now, lest we go too far on one side, it is certainly possible that someone who speaks well or sings well or who really does call upon us to pray or to study certainly may.
Mature.
It could be a mature person. So that's not really, and if that person, if someone wants us to pray, we can't all of a sudden say, okay, when I know they're immature or they're a pastor, okay, I know they must be immature. That's not at all what we're saying. But that's not the criteria that we need to really look at to say really what is maturity. So let's go on the other side and say, what is a mature person? And let's do that, can we, by again looking at those people. I really want to get to those people in the Bible.
Okay.
So I started with Paul, and we didn't get very far with him being the chief of sinners. We can continue with him or do Barnabas or David.
Well maybe let's go to Barnabas given where our discussion has come to. We can come back to Paul to make some other points maybe, but yeah, Barnabas is a remarkable person that just has really struck me. You know, we first meet him in the early part of Acts, where all these pilgrims have come to Jerusalem, and the experience at Pentecost happens, where in the upper room the flames of fire dance over their heads, and they speaking in languages that they don't know, praising God, the sound of a rushing wind. There's this remarkable event happens where the Spirit of truth comes upon them, and these disciples who were basically up to that point just had a very vague and fragmentary grasp of what all these events that had just transpired meant. All of a sudden it became crystal clear to them, and Peter can preach a sermon explaining what has gone on and what this is all about. And, you know, 5,000 people, is that right, believe on that in response to that first sermon. That's the day of Pentecost. Well, following that, you have a number of days, probably stretching into months, where this is such an exciting, dramatic, remarkable time that these pilgrims, instead of going home, they hang around. They stick around just to see what else is going to happen, just to see how this is all going to play out. I mean, I would have. I mean, I think I described in church what Woodstock was to the hippie generation, Pentecost was to these early Christians. It was this defining moment.
You'd have to be a hippie to really get that.
To understand that, yeah. But that's why they were hanging around. But unfortunately, as pilgrims, you know, they only have so many resources. Their home is the other end of the empire. They brought some provisions with them, but they only expected to stay a number of days, and now their visit has stretched on some days past that. They're getting to a point where they don't have money or whatever, provisions any longer. So there's this man named Joseph, who later, whose nickname is Barnabas. Barnabas means son of encouragement, I believe. I don't know. I want to look up the Aramaic there sometime and find out exactly. Barnabas, what is that in Aramaic? What does that mean exactly? What is the nuance of that? I don't know. But I think they translate it son of encouragement. But he's so characterized by whatever this quality is in his person that they give him a nickname to describe him by his moral character, by his moral quality. Because his given name is just Joseph. He's from Cyprus. And he is the one who decides, there are all these people, we need to take care of them. I've got some land. I'm going to sell the land. I'm going to liquidate my asset in this land and take the proceeds and give it to the apostles, and the apostles can make sure that everybody has enough to eat. Well, he's the first one that starts that, and then others follow and follow his example. But it was his generosity. It was his
initiation.
He initiated that whole practice in these first few months. That's the first time we meet him. I don't remember if we meet him again in the meantime, but most recently, where I've been studying, Saul, who is also named Paul, the apostle,
the killer of Christians,
has been converted and has spent some time getting his bearings and figuring out his life, and he eventually comes to Jerusalem for the first time. This may be as many as 4 years after he has been persecuting Christians, but maybe as few as 2 years, but somewhere from 2 to 4 years later, he comes to Jerusalem for the first time, returns to Jerusalem for the first time. And the rumors are that he's become a disciple, but the believers, the disciples in Jerusalem, are not willing to accept him into their, you know, into their community. They don't think he's really a believer. They think this is some kind of trap, some kind of way of catching them and identifying them and putting them in prison and executing them. I presumably that's their fear. Barnabas sits down with Paul, hears him out, hears his story, talks to him, and Saul lays out for Barnabas all that has happened and all that has transpired. Jesus appearing him on the road to Damascus, the commission that Jesus gave him about how he was going to be sent to kings and Gentiles and to the sons of Israel to testify of what he has heard and what he has been taught. And Barnabas hears all that. Barnabas believes him. He thinks it's genuine, he thinks it's authentic, and he basically takes him around and introduces him into the Christian community in Jerusalem. And Paul is then free to move among them, to socialize with them, and he evangelizes in the streets of Jerusalem.
Now, wasn't this in the place where the Christians were really still afraid of Paul because he had put them to death?
Right, exactly.
And so this was a quite a big step for Barnabas to take, to kind of, in a sense, be the introducer of Paul into these people who were really quite afraid of Paul.
Yes,
because
right.
of his history. And Barnabas was pretty courageous in doing that, or willing to look at Paul's character beyond what was obvious.
Yeah. I think what it shows me is what a good judge of character Barnabas was. He could tell a phony from a real one. He knew what was authentic and what wasn't authentic. You see him again with that judge of character. If you remember the story, when Barnabas and Paul went on their first missionary journey, they took a young protege named John Mark with them. And they traveled from Antioch to Cyprus, and they went evangelized through Cyprus. And then they left Cyprus to go up to the southern coast of what is now Turkey. And they were going to evangelize that area. But when they arrived there, John Mark decided that he was going to split. He wasn't going to stay the course on this journey that they were on. So he got on a boat from there and left, and I think went back to, maybe it doesn't say, I think he returned to Jerusalem. And that's all the text says, is that he left them. Well, on a subsequent missionary journey, I don't remember right now whether it was the second or the third one. It might have been the second one. Barnabas and Paul are going to go on this second journey. Barnabas wants to take John Mark with them. And Paul says no. He puts his foot down. No, we're not going to take John Mark. And I don't think the text elaborates on that, but reading between the lines, it seems to be Paul's attitude is John Mark's a quitter. He's a wimp. He's just going to bail out.
He left us before, he's going to do it again.
Yeah, he's just going to do it again. And Barnabas says, no, I want to take John Mark. And it becomes, the disagreement between them becomes, I think the text says it was a sharp disagreement between them, something to that effect. And the disagreement is so sharp that Barnabas says, I'm going to take John Mark, we'll go on our own journey. You know, blessings on you. You do your thing, but we're gonna do our own thing, and that's all you hear about it in Acts. But then, in the later letters of Paul, Paul talks again about, or says things that imply he is once again in association with John Mark. So it becomes apparent that John Mark has matured, has grown, has won back the respect of Paul, and. What that tells me is Barnabas was right.
He was a good judge of character.
Yeah, he was a good judge of character. He knew that John Mark had matured. He knew that he wasn't flaky. He knew that he wasn't going to bail out again, that whatever had happened the first time was not going to happen again. And Barnabas could see that. Paul was too stubborn to see that, or unable to see that for some reason. The only time where Barnabas is mentioned where... the account would have him in the wrong, and it depends on how you interpret it, is in the book of Galatians. Paul describes an encounter with Peter at Antioch where Paul and Barnabas and Peter and everybody involved in the mission to the Gentiles there at Antioch had been freely associating with the Gentiles, freely associating in the sense that they would even eat with them, something that a good Orthodox Jew of the time wouldn't have ever done, to have eaten with Gentiles. But they had brought themselves to a point where they had so accepted the Gentiles as co-heirs of the promises of God that they felt free to socialize with them and eat with them. Well, some people described as from the circumcision party, that is, Jews who believe that the only way Gentiles could really become heirs of the promises is if they converted to Judaism as well as believed in the Messiahship of Jesus.
And were circumcised in
their conversion. Yeah, and therefore were circumcised. So they wouldn't freely associate with the Gentiles. They thought that that was against their laws and was inappropriate, was morally and religiously inappropriate. So they refused to associate with them, and they ate separately and wouldn't eat with them. Well, they so intimidated Peter and the other people with him that Peter then began to withdraw from eating with the Gentiles and joined the people of the circumcision party in eating at separate tables or whatever they were doing, eating apart from them. And in that context, Paul says, even Barnabas was led away, and it either is led away into their hypocrisy or was swept away, or depends on how you translate that verb, by their hypocrisy. And it's not clear to me whether it's saying even open-hearted Barnabas became outraged at their hypocrisy. That's one possibility. Or it could be that he got swept away into their hypocrisy and he joined them. It's just not clear what Paul means in that context. But if it's the latter, then there was a case where we see some immaturity in Barnabas. We see Barnabas actually being not courageous when he should have been courageous. In that case, Paul was the one where right was on his side. He had the courage to stand up for what was true and what was right and hold the line, and perhaps Barnabas caved. But that's the only place where we see Barnabas making a mistake, if that even is rightly understood.
So that's the only place in Scripture we see him make a mistake. I don't think you're implying, that he never made other mistakes.
No, uh-uh.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So we're talking about him in relation to maturity. Where are we going?
Okay, so we had been talking about being advanced in the Christian culture, and that's not the right set of criteria. Where do we see the real maturity of Barnabas? I mean, what are the kinds of things that we see in Barnabas that tell us what a mature person he was? Well, Barnabas was generous in his attitudes. He wasn't judgmental. He wasn't condemning. He wasn't critical. He wasn't
quick to make a decision. He seems like he sat down with Paul and figured out who he was. Didn't just go along with the crowd.
Exactly.
He could have been very criticized and probably was. So not a person that was just following in the steps of what other people might want for him.
Right. It was important to him what was true about Paul. You know, not what we're afraid might be true, but what was the actual truth about Paul. And he was willing to find out. Hear Paul out, listen to him, judge, discern for himself. And then when he determined that his conversion was authentic, he had the courage to act on that. What we need to do is get the people not afraid of you any longer. We need to let me help. Let me do what I can. Let me be supportive here. Let me be a bridge between you and the community of Christians here in Jerusalem. Even more remarkable to me, this really struck me as I was studying this passage in Acts, even more remarkable is Barnabas is clearly a leader of sorts. He's well known, he's well liked, he's well received. When he does something, people emulate. I mean, the fact that he could be a bridge between the community and Paul, I think, speaks to the fact that he had influence in that community. They people trusted him.
Mm-hmm. He was definitely a well-known leader.
Uh-huh.
Someone who had, he was very seen.
Mm-hmm. If I put myself in Barnabas' shoes, here I am in this community. I'm a leader, I'm respected, I'm trusted, I'm looked up to. I have a real place of status, of prestige. Here's this Christian murderer comes into town, and he tells me this story. And the story is that Jesus appeared to him on the road to Damascus, and I was blinded, and Ananias came later and made a prophecy, and the prophecy included the fact that God was setting me, Paul, apart for this incredible role of being his spokesman who would take the message to the Gentiles and on and on and on. I think it's pretty apparent from those prophecies that the role, I mean, it's partly in retrospect, but I think from the prophecies at face value, it becomes apparent that Saul is being set apart by Jesus for a very significant role that has a lot of substance to it, a lot of responsibility to it. Here I am, this leader with status and prestige and the trust of the people in Jerusalem. Here this guy comes into town basically saying, Jesus has set me apart to be a pretty important person in his plans. What is my response going to be? I know the impulses that would arise, for sure. To be jealous, to be envious, to be protective of my position in my place. Am I going to have to live in the shadow of this guy? Is this guy going to become more important than me? Is he going to have more prestige than I have, more status, more of the trust of people than even I have attained here?
Am I going to step down and this murderer step up?
Exactly. Yeah, and the fact that he was a murderer would would ring really loud in my mind, because I've been a disciple from the beginning. This guy is a Johnny come lately who used to kill people like me. You know, he doesn't deserve to be the one that has been chosen by Jesus for this significant role.
So you might even have an attitude of outrage.
Outrage, exactly. Of the injustice of it, and so on. All those impulses would have arisen in me. They may very well have arisen in Barnabas. You know, we just don't know, because these accounts are not intended to be psychological journals of how these people did what they did and said what they said and responded the way they did. They may very well have arisen in Barnabas, but we see his actions. However much he struggled, the final outcome of what he did is he took the position that you see explicitly stated by John the Baptist with respect to Jesus. He must increase, I must decrease. That's essentially the position Barnabas took as well. You've been set aside by Jesus, then let me help. Then I will support that. I will step into the background, I will step into your shadow, and in your shadow, I will do everything I can to make what God wants to happen in your life happen. To the extent that I can lovingly be supportive of that, then that's what I will do. That's clearly the decision he made. He became his traveling partner, he became his compatriot, he became his helper, he became his aide. And not that Barnabas was not capable in his own right. He was. He was a very capable person. I mean, remember the account in the first missionary journey where these pagans that they are preaching the gospel to, because they perform miracles, they decide that they must be gods. They must be Zeus and Hermes. And they decide that that Barnabas is Zeus. You know, Zeus is the top god. They decide that Barnabas is the top god. Well, Barnabas must have been impressive enough in his own right to warrant being...
That's quite impressive.
...decided as Zeus, that he was Zeus. But he had a spirit of... Ultimately, his spirit was, God, your plans are what is important. Your will isn't what is important. I want to fit into your plans. And whatever that means for me, that's fine. I accept that. If I'm not the most important person in the universe, that's fine with me. If Paul is more important and more prestigious, that's fine with me. I just want what you want, God.
So maybe
that's incredible maturity to be able to say that.
A measure of maturity then is what you're saying is, I want what God wants. I want to promote his purposes. I want to promote his name. I want what God wants, even when it costs me. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're saying is it probably did cost him. In terms of his own prestige or standing in the community. He didn't get to be top dog, and yet he wanted what God wanted more. That's big, because one of the biggest things that we do in order to promote ourselves is to have prestige in some way. And I think if we go back to the examples of our youth, when you stood up and said, you know, we just don't pray enough. You were promoting Jack.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
It wasn't that there was any cost to Jack. It was Jack needs to get bigger, and it was at a cost to the other people that you did that, as you explained your story. And the same with both of our testimonies at that time. We were not promoting God. We were acting as though we did, but we were really promoting ourselves. And so it seems that a person who is mature is willing to take on the loss of the decisions they make. It costs them sometimes very dearly.
Mm-hmm.
And going back to our last program, it may not cost me in terms of just prestige, but it may cost me in terms of having more pain in my life. It may cost me in terms of not winning an argument. It may cost me in terms of having to look at the reality of my own selfishness and call it what it is and not be self-justifying or self-protected or defensive when I really need to see the sin or the wrong in my own heart and in my own actions.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so it's not just, okay, that was so big, you know, for Barnabas to step down with Paul, and we can say, hey, that's not really going to be an issue in my life, and I think absolutely it's an issue. We just need to tailor it, look at our lives and see where it fits, not that it doesn't.
Mm-hmm. And let's take this back and relate it to our earlier discussion about Christian culture and what are the criteria of Christian culture as well. What that suggests to me is, what Barnabas' example is, we really have no business calling mature the preacher, the minister, the head pastor, the elder, whoever in our churches, who talks a good game, is very impressive from the pulpit, for example, but when you watch behind the scenes, is very self-protective of his status and his prestige and his place in the church. He has to have the biggest office. He has to have a certain... he has to be elevated, and he has to have all the trappings around him of being elevated in the eyes of other people. That's really dangerous. Of all the people in the world who shouldn't need that, it should be those people who are claiming to be servants of Jesus. Jesus didn't demand that. Jesus didn't demand prestige. Jesus didn't demand that people stroke his ego every place he turned and every place that he was. He didn't need that because he knew who he was. He was God incarnate, King of the universe, and that was good enough for him. But it was his own knowledge of his own standing that was good enough. He didn't need the strokes of other men.
But, you know, it's really subtle, Jack. It could be that I'm a person in Christian ministry who, trying to put out a certain impression of myself, I will choose the least office. But in choosing the least office, I'm not doing it out of a maturity, but I could do it out of somebody, me wanting other people to think that I'm humble.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily do they have a big or small office either.
No, no.
It could go either way. And even somebody with a big office could be somebody who is quite mature. But what we're talking about is who are we trying to serve? Am I serving myself or am I serving God? And it's really a heart matter.
Yeah, exactly. An attitude, a heart matter. Where is it coming from? Whether I have a big office or a small office is totally immaterial, but is it a big deal to me? Well, then obviously I don't understand. If I pick the big office because I want that to represent my prestige, then that's a problem because it's my prestige that is really driving me. If I pick the small office because I want to look spiritual, then again, it's my appearances that are driving me, not the reality of loving and serving people and being obedient to God. I think what we see in the maturity of Barnabas is he truly wanted to serve the purposes of God and fit into those purposes. The outward status and prestige in the eyes of other people ultimately was not important to him by comparison. And if that's not true of our leaders, then they are not mature and they are not in a position to lead us where we need to go.
Okay, but I'm really with us there. But before we end this hour, I want to make sure that we go to the other side. And that's, so do you see Barnabas as a person that didn't really struggle also with life? Is a mature person, somebody who maybe elevates Paul easily? Or is a mature person somebody who struggles perhaps with the decision of stepping down, as in the case of Barnabas?
Yeah. Now, as I say, the accounts are not the sort of accounts that we have any way of knowing one way or the other. What I understand to be the concept of maturity in the New Testament, Barnabas may very well have struggled. He may very well have, and that's okay. The fact that he came out where he came out is the important thing. It means that he really was committed to the right set of values. His heart really was the heart of a disciple of Jesus, a child of God. I do think it's the case that the more readily we embrace the values of that Jesus is teaching us, the more mature we are. So the more easily, the more without struggle we are able to do it, or the more minimized the struggle is, the more mature we are. I think that's just simply true. But certainly there's nothing inauthentic about a faith that has great difficulty repudiating all those self-protective lust after prestige and status that are there, that are bubbling up from inside. If I with great difficulty put that down, the fact that I put it down, though, means that my spirituality is authentic. It's real. It's genuine. It's substantial. It's there. And in time, over the course of time, it'll be easier for me to do that as I become more mature. But I don't think we can even lay out a timetable for people. That's between God. I mean, that's up to God. God is the one who's authoring my sanctification. And we can't prescribe how easy it should be for people, or how far along they should be, or how far advanced they should be in that aspect of their spirituality. We're in no position to judge that.
I think we can say, though, Jack, in my case, I was really elevated to a level of spirituality very quick, or maturity very quick, in my Christian life. Certainly, when I was in high school, I was one of the leaders of the group, I think because I was a cheerleader. I think I had a social standing that gave that to me. In college, I was, at least in my graduate work, I went to a new town and I was immediately elevated very quickly, I think because I was verbal. I'm not really sure why, but I think what we need to say at least is a mature person is not somebody who comes out of the womb mature, or who becomes a believer and is suddenly mature. And I think that's something that I've heard you really talk a lot about with Paul, is that lots of times we see Paul on the road to Damascus having turned a corner, and all of a sudden he is a mature person. Well, definitely he turned a corner. Definitely he had what we might call a severe paradigm shift. And yet, I think a point you have made over and over again is it took him years to really mature.
Yeah.
And I think that's really reflected in his writing about his struggle, lots of struggles that he had in the process of becoming a more mature believer. It didn't happen overnight. It took years and years.
Can
you add to that?
Yeah, because if you look at the chronology of his life, early in his life are a couple of episodes of silent years. He's not writing. He's not teaching. He's just learning. He's at one point, I think, being instructed by Jesus himself. When he was in Tarsus, he may have been in Tarsus, and it doesn't give us a clue as to what he was doing there. It's possible that he was teaching. I think it's even likely that he was probably teaching, but we don't hear anything from that period. And that may have lasted as long as 9 years in the chronology of his life, a long time.
Yeah.
And that's an educated man learning. I mean, when we first meet him on the pages of the New Testament, he's been a student of the Rabbi Gamaliel for 10, 15 years of his life. He's well versed in the intellectual knowledge of the Old Testament and Scripture and so on. His learning is not at the level of getting up to speed intellectually. It's getting up to speed spiritually. It's getting up to speed existentially in terms of the impact, the implications that this has for his life. And, you know, we're talking about somewhere in the vicinity of 15 years before we really, before he goes on his first missionary journey and before he's really prepared to be a spokesman for Jesus with any sort of sophistication. Well, that's as it should be. I was just thinking about this the other day about Peter. Peter's first sermons are really pretty simple. They really come down to Jesus really is the Messiah. I'm not sure Peter had the sophisticated understanding at Pentecost that he did at the end of his life. At the end of his life, yes, he still proclaims and testifies that Jesus is the Messiah, but he sure understands a whole lot about that at the end that he didn't really as he stood up to preach that sermon at Pentecost. It's just that all the evidence suggests that there's growth that happened even in the apostles.
So a mature believer is never a new believer.
Right. Never.
Jack and Christine will return in a moment. Almost 20 years ago, the Mackenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon, was created as a place where people could come and seriously think about their faith. Over the years, Mackenzie has grown in different directions and gone through various changes, but one thing has remained constant: a passionate love of God's Word and the truth it contains. The Mackenzie staff is dedicated to studying and understanding the Bible. Individually, they want to know what the biblical authors meant when they wrote the Bible. They want to peel away layers of false teaching and get to the very heart of the biblical message. And this is not easy. It's hard work. It requires years of dedication and the willingness to believe what the Bible actually says rather than what they might want it to say. These men and women also believe their studies and their teaching are not perfect. They know their understanding is limited, and they may be wrong, but they trust God to give them the eyes to clearly see His truth. They also encourage others to join them in their efforts, to ask them tough questions, to challenge their conclusions, and to take the Bible seriously. More importantly, they desire that all may come to the wonderful saving truth of the gospel. Much of the teaching done at Mackenzie is available on tape and can be ordered from the tape catalog. Papers and the free monthly newsletter News and Views are also available. Information about how you can find out more about Mackenzie Study Center and its ministries will be given at the end of today's program. Now, let's return to Jack and Christine.
Christine, for a number of months now, we've been trying to let our listeners know where we stand financially and asking them to contribute as they can. We've got lots of feedback that the program has been helpful to people in a number of different ways. But do you know how we stand financially right now?
The small contributions have kind of trickled in. And in terms of larger contributions, I think we've gotten two. We actually got two $8,000 contributions. And the second $8,000 contribution, the people ask that we match the funds. So they will give up to $8,000 dependent on how much is given up to that amount. So it's a possible $16,000 contribution, which is pretty significant, and it's very encouraging.
So any of the listeners out there who are willing to make a contribution to match the funds, they could support us to the tune of another $8,000 then?
Right.
Great.
Which is pretty exciting.
Yeah.
So thank you for contributing, and we again encourage you to consider contributing if this program has been beneficial to you.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, would like to order other programs, or want to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, please call us at 541-485-4801. Again, that's area code 541-485-4801. You can write us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And you may also find us on the net at www.mackenziestudycenter.org. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa card. If you desire to support the ministry of Mackenzie Study Center, your gift will be entirely tax deductible. please mail your check to McKenzie Study Center. Again, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. The telephone number again, 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.